Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
We're back after that great word from our sponsor. And at this time now, joining us is Lisa Freeman. And we're going to be talking about the parole system and how she's found it and her book, She Won't Be Silenced. Thank you for taking the time to sit with us, Lisa.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay. Now, Lisa, before we get into the details, what drove you to write this book?
For me, it was, I wanted to have a permanent record of not only of my dad's murder, which is what the media focuses on, but a record of his life as well. And I wanted to document my struggles and what I have gone through trying to find some sort of justice within our justice system here, the correctional services system and the parole board system.
Now, when you
try to make a conversation and a dialogue around what's wrong, what I'm seeing, what's wrong, and shine a spotlight on the system and help other people, you know, who have to go through the same thing, if help them and make their path a little bit easier.
So now let's maybe review a little bit about the story. What got you into dealing with parole and the justice system? So what was the background?
In February 1991, my dad was taking care of some rooming houses here where I live for a friend of his that was at that time vacationing in Florida for the winter. A drifter by the name of Terry Porter previously lived in the house a few months before, and he came back to Ontario looking for his girlfriend. The owner of the house knew that they were having a very abusive relationship and moved her away. So this drifter comes back looking for the girlfriend, comes across my dad, who's there taking care of the place, filling in for the owner. And he's asking him where she is, and my dad, either he knew and didn't tell him or just really didn't know that where her new location was. And he ended up killing him simply because he didn't have the information he was looking for.
Yeah, oh, wow.
Yeah. So now what was his sentence for the murder?
His sentence, the trial was in the summer of 1992, and he pled the old charge of not guilty by reason of insanity. But the jury found him guilty, and he was sentenced to life in prison with no parole for 25 years.
Mm. Okay, so now we're up to the date where he's going up for parole. So what's the very first thing that happens to someone in your position when the person convicted of the crime goes up for parole? Are you notified? Like, how does that go?
Well, the very first thing that happened after the trial was that we were given a certificate of conviction that said just that. Life in prison, no parole for 25 years. So, you know, you do the math and it's right there. That would be 2016. So in 2011, I'm thinking, okay, I've got 5 years to prepare myself for something like this. Because for the 20 years in between the trial and, you know, the 5 year prep time that I was giving myself, you know, I didn't really talk about this to anybody. So I thought, you know, I need to make some contact with people. We had no idea where this man was, where he was in prison. We just knew it was Kingston. We didn't know anything else about it. You know, what his life was, what he did day to day. We had no information. So in 2011, I'm thinking, okay, I need some prep time. I made some phone calls, and it turned out I had to register as a victim with the Parole Board of Canada. And I did so, and said, you know, I know I'm 5 years too early. They said, no, that's fine. 3 months later, I get a letter in the mail from the parole board saying that I could go to Kingston, Ontario to do a victim impact statement because this offender was eligible for parole. And I said, no, you've got the math wrong. You're 5 years too early. And I said, it's supposed to be 2016. It's only 2011. And they said, well, no, that's just what the certificate says. That's not the reality of parole in this country. It actually starts much sooner. And I'm like, what? And they're like, well, they're eligible for different kinds of parole before mm-hmm. that parole mark. So here I am, 5 years before I thought I ever needed to be, thinking about parole. And it was escorted temporary absences. It was day parole, community service work, well in advance of that mark. So I'm caught off guard just by the fact that it's 5 years too early for me. And so that's where it all started. That's my introduction into the corrections and the parole system of Canada, that the certificate that we had all those years was actually worth nothing. Because, you know, that's what we looked at. We thought of it as, it's actually a false comfort. Not only deceptive, but it was a false comfort, thinking we had 25 years before we had to deal with any kind of parole. But in reality, it was 20 to 21 years before we had to think about it.
Wow.
What kind of, what was he trying to get? What kind of parole was he trying to get at that time, at the early mark?
Escorted temporary absences from the prison for rehabilitation purposes. Turned out to be community service work and stays in halfway houses as well.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Does that
scare you or does it worry you?
It worries me a lot for a few reasons. First of all, it's well before not just myself and my family ever thought, but well before the public ever thinks, because that's the sentence here. And it's often repeated, you know, life in prison, no parole for 25 years. But in reality, these dangerous criminals are out on the street doing, you know, community service work. They're out on day passes. They're in halfway houses. Well before the public ever even realizes that they're out there. It's just happenstance that the public does find out, because usually it's you know, they don't advertise it that people are out early. It's just by happenstance that I'm a registered victim with the parole board that I'm finding out at all. And I'm glad that I did register what I did, because if I would have waited until 2016, all these things would have happened and I wouldn't have known about it, which is not right.
Now, so now, what's the process that you have to go through, with a parole board? Like, what is it you're required to do?
Register. They want you to register as a victim of crime. And when I was first told I had to register as a victim, I said, I'm not registering as a victim because I've never considered myself a victim. My dad's a victim. I'm the secondary victim, really, as a family member. And with the trial in 1992, we had no support as a family because at that time in Canada, there were no victim services. There was no dedicated professionals to help people like us. And we weren't allowed to do a victim impact statement in court. So we had nobody to advocate for us. And it was just my older sister and I who went to the trial every day. And we had asked if we could do a victim impact statement. And we were told by the lead prosecutor at the time that you couldn't, that we couldn't, because it would have no effect on anything, that it wouldn't make any difference to what the judge had said or whatever sentence he would come down with. But interestingly enough, Terry Porter, so the man who killed my dad, was allowed to take the stand one last time to say what he wanted to say. And he said he wasn't sorry for what he did. He was just sorry that he got caught. So fast forward 20 years, I'm being asked to register as a victim. I said there was no victim services or any advocates, but there was one detective who was very, very good to my sister and I. And after the trial, he took me aside and he said, you know, it's okay to be angry at what you've seen and what you've heard, but don't be bitter. Because if you become bitter, then Terry Porter has another victim. And I never forgot those words. So you fast forward 20 years when I'm being asked to, you know, register as a victim. I didn't like that a lot at all because in my mind, I wasn't a victim. So that's the first stage. You register as a victim and then I always say it's like the floodgates open. Everything I was wondering for the 20 years is suddenly being sent to me. Reports on his institutional behavior, what courses he's taken, how he has done in those courses, if he's taken anger management, if he's had any disciplinary measures taken in prison. All those things I was wondering are suddenly in my mailbox. And it was information overload. Because as I said, I didn't have anything for 2 decades. And then there it is, back in front of me again. 5 years before I thought I would ever need to deal with it. So it was a lot of adjusting to get back into that frame of mind and to process it all. So that's the first thing you do is you register as a victim. And then you just go through the system. They notify you when hearings are coming up and when you can do an impact statement. You know, there's a whole website and lots of literature to guide you through the process. But the reality of dealing within the system differs greatly from what correctional services and the parole board presents to people. It's not what you're reading. The experience doesn't match the description of what they tell you it will be like.
So what exactly is the difference? Like, what are you saying that they portray, and then what reality is? What are the key points?
Well, they put out there, you know, how important it is to do a victim impact statement, which it is, and really that's your only opportunity to say what you need to say. To say how this has impacted your life, and not only just your life, but the other people in your family. So, you know, you write these statements, but they have the opportunity to redact it. If they don't like what you've written, they send it back for you to change. And the Parole Board of Canada and Correctional Services Canada have a whole list of do and do not suggestions for impact statements. And, again, I disagree with that because it's such an offender-driven system shouldn't be telling victims of crime what to write. And it comes down to, you know, make your impact statement about 10 minutes. Well, why would they put a limit on something like this? I had 2 decades of what I felt I needed to say, and they shouldn't be, you know, watching the clock while I'm saying it. It came down to little things like I wanted to stand to read my impact statement. And they said, no, you need to sit down and read it. And I challenged them. And in the end, they let me stand to read it because nobody sits down to read a statement. I wanted to read it last so the panelists had my words and my thoughts and my feelings in their minds when they went off to make their decisions. They said, no, you have to read it first because the offender has the last word. And at the end of all that, they gave a little bit and let me read second to last, so before the offenders. So they're putting it out there that you've got all these choices. You've got, you know, it's your impact statement, your value to this process. But when it comes right down to it, it is a very offender-driven system. And I had people at corrections and the parole board remind me several times that it's not my hearing. And I would say, well, it is my hearing. I'm here speaking, you know, for my dad, speaking for my family. I need to play a part in this somewhere and not just the little role that you're giving me. And with, you know, being persistent, I did get my way for quite a few things. But at the same time, I shouldn't have to, it shouldn't be that hard. It shouldn't be so many hoops that I have to jump through just to read an impact statement that how I wanted to read it and what I felt should be in it.
Wow. So you're in essence feeling like the parole board's not really there for the victim.
No, no, not at all. It's not at all. It's very offender driven. And as the parole process has unfolded since 2011, right up until today, every interaction I have with them, that drives that home even more. He waived, for example, Terry Porter waived his right to full parole in 2016. And I had a letter come in the mail saying he waived his right to parole in 2016. And the next scheduled parole hearing is December of 2020. And I thought, okay, that gives me 4 years, so I don't have to think about this anymore. But the very next sentence in the letter said that, you know, the next scheduled date is 2020 unless he chooses to have it earlier. And I thought, well, why would you do that? Why would you put that the next date is 2020 unless the offender decides to have it sooner? That doesn't make sense to me. If you miss a bus, you don't get to dial up a bus to come by. You have to wait till the next one. So, as I said, through the years, everything that I've learned, everything that I've, you know, come across, it just reinforces that first thought that in my head, this is so offender-driven. And I think anybody who navigates through this system would agree with me. And the public as well, from what they will see, will agree that it is offender-driven.
Yeah. I've talked – oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I've talked to a number of people in the same position as you, and all of them echo what you've said to me. Especially what stands out to me is that the offender has the last word. That's really shocking that, you know, in this day and age, we allow this person who has essentially ruined your life to have the last word.
Exactly. And it even extends to the panel hearing that I attended in 2012 in Kingston, Ontario. As I said, I had 20 years of not speaking about it to anyone. The older sister who came with me, attended the trial every day with me, had since passed away. So, you know, I went on my own, and I did have my husband with me, but I was there representing my family by myself. And during the panel hearing, there was three panelists, and one of them introduced me twice by full name in front of this man who killed my dad. And when I came back home and let, you know, the dust settle and everything, you know, thinking about everything, you know, that really bothered me. That really bothered me that they thought that was an okay thing to do. And I went through the chain of command, contacting people in corrections and the parole board complaining about that. And I was told repeatedly that it's his right to know who's complaining about him. And I thought, well, that's wrong. That fundamentally is wrong, that they feel that they can just say my name, introduce me like I'm at some sort of cocktail party at the beginning and at the end of this panel hearing with the man who axed my father to death sitting 10 feet away from me. That was completely and totally wrong, and they didn't own it. It was like, well, it's his hearing. It's his right to know who's complaining about him, and that's basically it, and completely wrong. Completely wrong. And re-traumatizing, re-victimizing, you know, very hard to deal with that.
So it's almost like they're there to defend and help the convict.
Of course, yes, it is exactly it. Because if they're, able to say my name and introduce me twice in front of this man, but yet at the same time, every letter I get from corrections, every piece of information I get from the parole board, on the top of the letter is a confidentiality banner that states, I'm not allowed to talk about what's in there. I'm not allowed to take it to the media. I'm not allowed to post it online. But yet they're able to impose that on me to basically gag me from speaking. But yet they're able to tell this offender my name and say it in front of him. Like, to me, that was just, okay, at that point, it's like, all right, you know, the gloves are off. I do understand data confidentiality. I completely understand that, but not in this situation. For me, it was like, if you think it's okay to breach my privacy by what you did in an environment that I should have felt I could be protected in, then I'm going to breach your confidentiality banner, and I will speak to the media, and I will post online what you're telling me, because the public has the right to know how you operate. And so that's what I've been doing over the last, you know, X amount of years since that time.
How have they responded toward that? Like, has corrections been involved?
They're not happy about it. I had posted online for my Justice for Dad page on Facebook that I had a letter from corrections saying that Terry Porter was doing community service work in the Kingston and Gananoque area, but his past history was protected from not only the public, but...
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
People that he was working alongside of. And I didn't think that was right. And that went in the Toronto Sun as well. And I was contacted. Corrections called me. I was at work and I took the phone call saying I needed to take that down because it was a security breach and it was putting the institution at risk, and it was putting the public at risk, and it was putting the offender at risk. And my response was, that's unfortunate. I'm not taking it down. And they never bothered me again after that, because I feel, you know, I'm validated. Like I said, I understand data confidentiality. I understand that, but not in this regard, not where my privacy and my very basic things like my name isn't protected. So to me, it just balanced out somewhat. And that's a standard confidentiality banner. And it protects the offender, because it protects him from having the public know what he's up to. And I think that's wrong as well. And, you know, I still talk about what I receive in the mail. I haven't had any other contact from corrections or the parole board saying not to speak about it anymore. I think they just generally leave me alone, just to do whatever I do. But it's not just me. I think other victims of crime are now doing it as well, because it's just the balance needs to be back there somewhere, that the rights of, you know, anybody who's looking at this can see that the rights of the victims are so much less than the rights of the offenders. So in this day and age of social media, things will get out and people will talk about it. And I think that's great. I think that's what needs to happen, because it highlights deficiencies in the system and it highlights how uneven things are for people in this system.
Have you had any feedback from any of your political people or people in your area that you're from? Like, are they supportive, or do they even talk to you about it? Or
I have an MP who's very supportive, who lives in the area that I live in. And he has, I remember going to see him in 2012 when all this was unfolding 5 years early. And he was again, shocked, because if you're not in this system, you don't know how it works, right? So he was shocked and he was surprised. And, you know, he has been with me right along the way. His name is Dr. Colin Carey, and he's my local MP. And, you know, he not just being a politician, I think he just gets it as a citizen of this country that it's wrong. So I have had, I'm a great letter writer, and I've had other politicians not even bother answering my letters or, you know, addressing my concerns, but this one gentleman has. And recently, in June, in Ottawa, he tabled a bill in Parliament, Bill C-466, that is just an amendment to the Corrections and Conditional Release Act to include why an offender is being released out of prison early. That is just such a simple ask. But we will see how that unfolds this fall. Like, we have an election here in Canada, so we will see if this bill gets any traction. But it's just such a simple ask and really a no-brainer. But he did that, and another MP, Lisa Raitt out of Milton, Ontario, was there as well for that and backed it. So I do have good people. I always say you need good people around you to support you, and I am very lucky that I do have good people around me.
Now, have you had a chance to speak to him, the criminal himself?
It's very interesting that you're bringing things up that are actually happening in the here and now in my life with what I'm dealing with. I was in Victoria. I don't know how you're doing that,
you seem to be tuned in. And the government.
you're very in tune with what I'm dealing with. Like, even today, like literally this morning,
wow.
this man is now, and I use the word incarcerated very lightly. He's now in William Head Institute in Victoria, British Columbia, and mm-hmm. he's been there since 2017. And anyone in Canada, everybody knows it's called Club Fed, with a good reason, because it looks more like a resort than a jail. Inmates live in duplexes with multi-purpose buildings on site with pool tables, motivational gardens and stone circles, you know, all these kind of things. He is now currently eligible, and he does have 60 hours a month time to attend AA meetings off-site and walks and talks with a psychiatrist. So that's where he is now. In March of this year, I flew out west to attend a panel hearing to get, it was for those walks and talks with the psychiatrist. So it was just to get that approved. And I was able to deliver a victim impact statement. And the hearing was about, I'd say it was about an hour and a half long. For the duration of that hearing, including when I delivered my impact statement, this offender sat with his back to me for the entire time. And I was so offended. I was so distressed by it because, to me, that's just a sign of rudeness. You don't sit with your back to people, especially if you're somebody who is, you know, I'm under the guise of rehabilitation, right? He's coming up to full parole. You don't sit with your back to somebody. First of all, it's rude. Secondly, you know, you gauge body language to see if there's remorse or whatever. But I was very offended by that. And after the hearing, I said to the regional communication officer, I said, you know what, that's not right. I'm distressed. I'm upset. He sat with his back to me. How can he be held accountable in that moment when his back's to me and I'm speaking to the back of his head? And she, her response to me was, well, that's how most victims of crime want it. And I'm like, well, the, you know, you have to have room for people like me who need to see accountability in someone. So, yes, I have seen him. I saw him in 2012, and I saw him in 2019, just like a few short months ago. And with that whole situation with his back of his head to me, that to me is just, again, Correctional Services Canada and the parole board enabling this offender. Like, how easy is that to sit there and talk about stuff and not have to look at your victim's family member? Yeah. I just thought it was a literally free pass for this guy, and he was not accountable.
Yeah, it's arrogant, and he's not showing any sign of remorse or recovery. Or,
yeah.
I'm sorry I did this, and,
yeah.
And I'm trying to be better.
And, see, and for me to hold my tongue for 90 minutes is nothing short of, it's not easy to do, but you're not allowed to say anything except what you've got written in your impact statement. Because if you say something, if like, if, let's say I just started, excuse me, why is this man with his back to me? Like, you know, don't I deserve a little bit of respect? If I did that, the offender has the right to file an appeal if he didn't get what he was asking for based on my behavior that day. Now, how ludicrous is that? So you have to keep quiet. Yeah, exactly. So you have to keep quiet. And it was afterwards when I got back to Ontario. Again, I was upset right then, and I'm still upset even to this day that that happened, because it's not just having him be accountable for his actions. Again, Correctional Services Canada and the parole board have got to be accountable for theirs, because that's the way they do it, and that's not right. I took the complaint to the chair of the parole board here in Canada, and we're trying to sort that out. They're trying to reflect exactly what I complained about, and they're on draft two of the letter because it's still not right. And it's not just an apology, and it's not just a letter that I'm looking for. I'm looking for change, so it doesn't happen, because I'm sure there's other people out there like me who would think that's, maybe there are people who are fine with that, but there has to be room for people who aren't fine with something like that. And there has to be the choice, I think, where you don't have control on so many things in like a tragedy or a trauma or a murder or a crime of this magnitude. You try to control what you can control. You try to limit the unknowns in situations. And, you know, they're like, oh, well, you could have applied for a seating arrangement change. And I said, well, you can't apply for something if you don't know it even exists, right?
Right.
So, you know, they need to be accountable for their actions, and they need to be accountable. Terry Porter, again, to me, after all these years, should be turning around and facing his victim's family. To me, that's, again, a no-brainer. And if that's the way it's done, ask me if I'm comfortable with that, instead of just putting his back to me. And to me, writing that impact statement that I labored over lost a lot of its impact because I'm speaking to the back of somebody's head, right? And again, I shouldn't have to deal with that. Like, it's such a hard time to begin with. All these other little extra things that go on shouldn't happen, because really nobody needs to go through that. And it's just an uphill battle sometimes making people who are to see things from the non-offender's point of view. And, I say to people, if I had 3 lifetimes, I'd never cover as much as I need to with corrections in the full board, because it's like I turn over a rock and all this other stuff crawls out. And it's like, okay, that needs to be looked at. That needs to be addressed. And here in Canada, we don't have one dedicated body that's a public advocate for victims of crime. Again, that's not right either. So, you know, you don't have one place you can go and say, this is what's happening, you know, this is my experience. We have the Ombudsman's Office for Victims of Crime, but they don't publicly advocate for victims. That instead seems to fall to various individual citizens, like citizen initiatives across this country, who individually or by bonding with other people in the same kind of situation, it's up to them to try to make inroads, to try to draw attention to these huge deficits in our system. And it's to Correctional Services Canada's advantage that we don't have a body that publicly advocates for us. So, again, the offender wins there too, right?
Yeah. I have a question about back to him having his back turned to you.
Right.
I believe there's a program in Canada where an offender can actually sit down with the victim's family. Is that something that he's ever suggested, or something that you would be interested in at all?
Okay. Again, you're right on cue with what I'm dealing with, which I think is just a little bit scary, but a welcome question for sure, because that's called restorative justice. And after this hearing in March, where I was so affronted and so offended and just distressed about it, I thought, what am I going to do now? I'm running out of time, right? I need to have him, to hold him accountable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even if he doesn't listen to me or hear me, facing me will make me feel better, because I know I'm delivering the message in the best way possible.
Right.
So, we have in Canada, highly touted by Correctional Services Canada, restorative justice. And I have trouble with the words restorative and justice being in the same sentence. So I called them up and said that to them. I said, I'm not interested in forgiveness. I'm not interested in any of that. I was very honest with them. I told them what happened in March. They said, well, we call it the Victim Offender Mediation Program. And they said, you can sit down one-on-one with this person. And I said, well, it wouldn't be nice. I said, I'm not there to forgive. I would be there to say exactly what I need to say and deliver it the way I want to deliver it, and then just get up and leave, right? Because to me, that was an opportunity missed in March. So I'm exploring that. I got their criteria leaflet online and looked at that. The criteria is that you live in British Columbia or the Yukon. And I phoned them up and I said, I'm in Ontario.
Is it not a federal institution? That doesn't make any sense.
It is a federal institution with a federal crime. So again, that's like with the other million things I need to, that's that rock I said that you turn over and all these other things come out.
Well, you can give my address if you want to, if that makes
sense. Oh, thank you. There you go. I'll be your house guest for a week or whatever it takes.
Yeah, whatever it takes.
We can try to accommodate, the best we can. But to me, the point is, Correctional Services Canada should not be touting this as an alternative when it's not applicable to everybody in the country. Right? Like that's the problem. You have to get to the root of the problem in my mind. And that correction shouldn't be putting that out there if it's not applicable and easily accessible by everybody. And this is a big country. However, don't put it out there to other people in other provinces if it's not something that's easily accessible. just the whole, and you know, do I want to sit down with this guy? Not really. But in order to maybe get some satisfaction and undo the damage done at that March panel hearing, I probably would sit down and say what I need to say and then hopefully just let that part go. But I'm not there yet because everything's developing, like, as we speak. But so many different things.
Well, and who's to say? Because maybe if you sat down, you wouldn't be allowed to say certain things, too, right? Who's to say how restrictive?
I know. They're telling me that I can say what I like, but I already, I already have multiple examples of them telling me one thing and it, the reality being something different, going right back to 1991 with that certificate of conviction.
Exactly.
Well, here's what they're telling me, life in prison, no parole for 25 years. Surprise, the reality is he's out doing, walking the streets at 21 years. So I used to be naive. I used to think that a well-worded and a well-delivered impact statement would keep an axe murderer off the streets. I'm not that naive anymore because I've been educated in the reality of what it's like to try to navigate through this system. And I am sure that anybody in my position, anybody who's had to try to navigate through corrections and the parole board, I'd be surprised if anybody had a shred of confidence left in them because I certainly don't.
Yeah.
And I think the majority of people don't either.
Do you have a website or anything that people can keep up with you, or like, where do you put all your information so people can read it?
I have Justice for Dad, so Justice, the number 4 Dad on Facebook that I started years ago. It was first of all to keep my family across the country informed of what was going on, because even though I'm the public face of the family, I've got a lot of people, you know, in my family who support what I do. And, not just me, but in my dad's memory as well, right? Just to keep things, you know, in the forefront. But over the years, that has grown, which is great, because people are interested. And it's not just other victims of crime, it's the public as well, that as these stories get out, as more people break the confidentiality banners, the public is more aware, too. And they're offended by it, as they should be, right? Because... Right? And that's what happens. And I think social media for that is great because it unites people across this country. Murder is very isolating. When this happened, I was 21. I had to ID my dad in the morgue, right? So that just kind of puts you in a different kind of league of everybody else, all your friendships. You know, if you didn't know me then, as the years went by, you didn't know what happened because it's very isolating. And it just came to the point where you just didn't want to talk about it anymore. I said that my older sister had passed away, so that just isolates you even more. And then, fast forward 2 decades, you have all this coming out from corrections and the parole board. And, you know, and then them naming me at the panel hearing, it's like, okay, you know what, you make a decision. Do you keep quiet like you have, or do you go public, so to speak, and bring this to the fore? And that's not an easy thing to do, but you do it because, again, that's what propels people, because they don't, it's wrong, it's fundamentally wrong that all this is happening and that the public really isn't aware of it. And I think that's not just me, but I think it propels a lot of victims of crime that do speak up, just the frustration of dealing with this system.
I was just going to say we are quickly running out of time, and I want to get your book in there. So your book, She Won't Be Silenced, is available at all bookstores and Amazon, of course, and we'll have it on our website as well, so people can just do one click and buy it when they're listening to the show. So
fantastic.
Well, Lisa, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or show, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.